I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
President George Bush is campaigning in New Hampshire today on his way to a weekend at his parents' home in Kennebunkport, Maine. New Hampshire is seen as an important swing state in this election year. Bush won the state narrowly in the 2000 campaign, but if its four electoral votes had gone the other way, Al Gore would be president. Both candidates this year are targeting a small population of undecided voters in the state, like Dover resident Jack Warren.
I want to see how both candidates and their parties stand on all the issues. You know, you hear a lot of things in the paper, you hear things in the news. I need to take the time and sit down and listen to both of them speak.
WBUR's Fred Tice is in New Hampshire, and he's joining us now on the line. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Gil.
So President Bush is visiting a town very near the border with Massachusetts, which, of course, is John Kerry's home state. Is this mostly a matter of convenience? It is, after all, right on the way to Kennebunkport.
Oh, no, this is not about convenience at all. This is a key state that he needs. As you pointed out, he barely won the state 4 years ago against Al Gore, and he needs to win it again. I mean, there's one of the many states where the battle is very, very, very tight, and he has picked this town, Stratum, because it is a town that went barely for Bush 4 years ago. And it, like many of the other towns near the Massachusetts border in southeastern Massachusetts, are towns that he has got to carry. I spoke recently to Professor of Political Science Dante Scala from St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire, and here's how he described the lay of the land here.
And it's those places where I suspect you'll find a good number of more moderate Republicans and also a good number of people who are fairly new to the state. They may be the ones who decide this election either way. And a problem for George Bush, perhaps, is that those new residents tend to be more attuned to, say, Boston and the Boston Globe than, say, the Manchester Union leader.
So the Manchester Union leader is, of course, a Republican force in New Hampshire. New Hampshire has traditionally been a Republican state, but over the years, as it's gotten more and more people coming in from over the border, from Massachusetts, it's become much more of a battleground state.
Well, and indeed, as the professor noted, there's a real north-south divide in New Hampshire. Many more people live in the southern part of the state. So what are the numbers there? Is anyone doing any current polling?
Yes. A recent poll conducted by the University of New Hampshire Survey Center before the Democratic National Convention showed John Kerry with 50% of the vote, George W. Bush with 45%, and there's a 4.5 margin of error, percent margin of error either way. So essentially that means they're in a statistical tie here in New Hampshire right now.
Is it hard to find that elusive undecided voter as you're going around?
Well, you find them. They're certainly there, but like in most other parts of the United States, the undecideds are a very small percentage, probably 5% or less. And what you are seeing is that most people have made up their minds one way or another. Here in Stratum, you're likely to see people who are already for President Bush come to this picnic, of course, but that's typical of any campaign event. But all over the country now, the number of undecideds are really very, very, very small, about 5%.
Thank you, Fred.
You're welcome, Gail.
WBUR's Fred Tice. Clearer connections are being drawn today between the terror alerts in this country and numerous arrests of terror suspects in Britain and Pakistan this week. Officials now say one of the 12 terror suspects rounded up in Britain is also the man whose activities prompted this week's terror alerts. Asa Al-Hindi is suspected of writing the reports detailing the security and construction of financial institutions in New York, New Jersey, and Washington. Maps, photographs, and other details Al-Hindi is accused of providing were found on the computers of two al-Qaeda suspects arrested in Pakistan last month.
Meanwhile, U.S. intelligence officials believe the capture of Ahmed Khalfan Gailani 2 weeks ago is crucial to cracking the shadowy world of the al-Qaeda West African diamond trade. Tanzanian Gailani was arrested by Pakistani authorities, and for more on this story, we turn to Doug Farah. He's a reporter on leave from The Washington Post and author of the new book, Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. Doug, first question, why diamonds?
Diamonds are extremely useful because you have extremely high value in very small volume. They're easy to transport across boundaries, and they're also very easy to convert back into cash when you need cash back. And so they're essentially an ideal form of holding in cash for terrorists or anybody else who wants to move money easily.
And in the diamond trade, they don't really want to know what you want them for.
They don't really care at all, no.
Mm-hmm. And why West Africa? I mean, obviously that's where the diamonds are, but why else?
Because you essentially had failed states there. You had a criminal enterprise in the form of the government of President Charles Taylor there. He allowed al-Qaeda to operate there, Hezbollah to operate there. It was a Disneyland for criminals where you could get diplomatic passports, register your aircraft illegally, do any number of things that made it very easy for criminals and terrorists to operate.
And we know that intelligence officials, U.S. intelligence officials, knew the whereabouts of Gailani in November of 2001, right after the 9/11 attacks, knew that he was in Liberia. There was an attempt to capture him. It failed. Why?
Well, essentially, they stood up a special forces unit that was training folks in neighboring Guinea, but they didn't have any way to do the final reconnaissance at that point. They didn't have anyone who spoke Creole. They didn't have anyone who could infiltrate in and reconnoiter the camp, which was a highly secure camp run by Taylor. So after about a week of trying to figure out how to do it, they simply called it off.
Mm. You've been writing about the ties between al-Qaeda and the West African diamond trade for a while. And then you also wrote in a July op-ed piece in the Washington Post that General Charles Ward, who's commander of the European Central Command, warned that al-Qaeda is very active and its activity is growing in Africa, that al-Qaeda is still very much in the diamond trade. But you also write that the intelligence community dismisses his and your concerns. Why?
Well, I think because it's outside the box, it's something new that they're not used to thinking about, and they don't know anything about the region, and they basically have no assets in the region. And instead of facing that and being able to say that, I think it's much easier to say the problem doesn't exist than to admit that we have no assets on the ground, we don't know what's going on there, and there's no quick way for us to bring ourselves up to speed on these essentially stateless areas of the world, the gray state areas. So these are the places where terrorists will be moving to. Is there other sanctuaries are squished, and it's very difficult for the intelligence community to change its culture and begin focusing on these areas, and it's a lot of work.
But Douglas, just doesn't the intelligence community have at least one point in that they did get Gailani in Pakistan?
They did, but that doesn't address the issues of stateless areas. I don't think that the intelligence community is a miserable failure by any stretch of the imagination. I think they're much better now in tracing this kind of stuff than they were prior to 9/11, but I think there's a long ways to go in figuring out how to work in the sanctuaries that these people will now seek.
Gailani has been captured, but could the U.S. go further and freeze the diamond trade? Is there any way to cut off that source of funds for al-Qaeda?
Not without shutting down a $7 billion a year industry, which no one wants to do. The dirty money coming from diamonds going to terrorists is an infinitesimally small part of that trade. And shutting down the trade to get at that would probably do more harm than good. Mm-hmm. It requires intelligence on the ground to find out where this stuff is moving, which is how I got the story and other people got the story. And until we have that kind of intelligence capability, regulation is simply not an answer.
Douglas Farah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Reporter Douglas Farah, author of the book Blood from Stones, The Secret Financial Network of Terror. He's also a senior fellow at the National Strategy Information Center. Well, the Sudanese government in East Africa has reportedly come to an agreement with the UN that would disarm the Janjaweed, the brutal government-backed militia, and address Sudan's humanitarian crisis, generally considered the worst in the world. There are also plans to deploy 2,000 African peacekeeping troops to Sudan, ravaged by civil war in the south and by what many are calling genocide in the city of Darfur, where the Janjaweed have murdered thousands. John Prendergast of the International Crisis Group recently returned from the region. We asked him, if the humanitarian crisis in Sudan goes unchecked, will that country return to its past sponsorship of terrorism?
Yeah, I mean, there's a potential very much still in existence of a resumption of the ties that built this government during the 1990s. And, of course, Osama bin Laden lived in Sudan for 6 years, and during that time, the Sudan government was very aggressive in pursuing relationships with all manner of terrorist organizations around the world. The Khartoum government was able to access all kinds of funding in exchange for the provision of safe haven. Now, because the oil industry has taken off in Sudan, they've been able to replace some of that, and so they're not as it's not as urgent a need for the Sudanese regime to be involved in these relationships. But if it becomes the pariah that it once was, and it somehow maintains power and doesn't have to share power with all these other groups that are fighting against it, then you have a very real chance of it sort of going rogue again.
Well, what should be done? I mean, as you know, the regime in Khartoum is still on the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. The phrase regime change comes to mind. Is that what you think is called for?
I think there's because the world and even the United States government aren't willing to go in that direction, I think there are a lot of steps that could be taken now. And there are very distinct choices at hand now for the United States government. Will we or will we not provide the necessary resources for a much more robust humanitarian assistance effort? Because right now, we're not reaching one-third of the people that need aid in Sudan. So that's a choice. The second choice is, are we going to do what it takes to provide security to people? That means we got to make sure that all these African troops get deployed rapidly into the theater, into Darfur, and are out there protecting people, and we're providing the logistics to make sure that those people are well provisioned and they can move around and they can protect civilians in the way that they should. Thirdly, the third choice is going to be whether or not we introduce the concept of accountability, because Khartoum will continue to do what it does. The government in Khartoum will continue to do what it does until there's some kind of cost to it. And if we don't start imposing targeted sanctions, laying the groundwork for war crimes tribunals and all the kinds of things that will make real the warnings and the threats that we've been making now for months and months and months against the government, they will just simply continue to obstruct the humanitarian effort and continue to allow the Janjaweed to run wild.
How does the U.S. avoid the perception in the rest of the world that this is another attack on Islam?
Well, by aggressively thwarting that image by saying that we are trying to protect the victims of this thing, which are 100% Muslim. We have, at this point, the kind of support we want to give to the African troops that are going to go in the next few weeks to protect civilians. They're going in to protect Muslims. And so I think that at this point, it's a question of public diplomacy, of being assertive and saying what we're standing up for rather than cowering and worrying about what everybody else thinks. Well, we got to do that in a way that enlists our friends in the Middle East and our friends around the Arab and Muslim world and say, hey, here's what we're trying to do. Let's work together and do it and help us explain it, because this is a situation which we're going to go in and protect Islamic populations.
John, thank you so much.
Thank you.
John Prendergast is special advisor to the president of the International Crisis Group.
Just ahead, Athenians put on their party face and their party manners as they get ready for the start of the Olympics next week.
And later, how one city in the Arab world is reacting to Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's here and now.
In just 1 week, the Olympic Games begin in Athens, Greece. In just a moment, we'll speak with an Athenian couple about the mood in the city these days and about daily life there as the Games draw near. But first, we turn to Alexis Papihelas, a journalist for the television network Mega Channel. Welcome, Alexi.
Good to be with you.
Well, first things first, are you folks all set? Is Athens ready for what's about to happen there?
Oh, yes, I think we're gearing up. We're sort of well-known for doing things at the last minute, so everybody's getting their tickets now, even though the tickets have been available for, you know, more than 6 months. I think we're set for it.
And what's happening in terms of the finances? Because the numbers we're seeing are that the games are going to cost over $7 billion. That's more than double what the 2000 Sydney Olympics were, and 30% more than what was originally expected. How is all of this going to be paid for?
Well, that's a very good question. We're not dealing with that right now. Everybody's, you know, sort of waiting for the games to end, and then I think there's going to be a lot of debate about why the budget, you know, is so high. Nobody really has a clear picture of, you know, what the games are going to cost exactly. And of course, you know, part of the reason, you know, we've spent so much money is the security situation. I mean, we didn't have 9/11 when Greece got the games, and it's a completely different security situation. And I think the security budget itself is almost triple what it was in Sydney, and that has really contributed, I think, significantly to this, you know, financial burden.
Yes, indeed. Well, the security costs alone, looks as if they're going to be about $1.2 billion. And they include a surveillance blimp over the city, which I guess not everybody's happy about.
Well, no, I mean, we don't really have a, you know, a tight security culture in this country. And the fact that, you know, we have cameras all over the place, I think there are more than 250 cameras all over the, you know, the main streets in downtown Athens. And then, you know, you have this huge and rather intrusive blimp circulating over Athens. It's not a very sort of pleasant kind of situation. There are people who are very upset. They've taken the government to court, and I don't think the court is going to decide on this until the games are over, for obvious political reasons, but still, there is a lot of debate about that, too. At the same time, you know, I think people realize that after 9/11, the international security environment is very different, and they realize that when we're talking about the Olympic Games, we're not talking about the Greek event, we're talking about the limelight in terms of the international scene.
Well, thanks so much, Alexei. Hope it goes well.
Thank you very much.
Alexis Papahelas is a journalist for Mega Channel Television in Athens, Greece. And now for a citizen's eye view, we turn to two Athenians, John Philipson and Connie Lambrou Philipson. He is a geologist, she an archaeologist and nutrition expert. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Well, perhaps we should mention at the outset that, Connie, you're talking to us from your apartment in downtown Athens, and, John, you are at your weekend getaway outside the city. So it's been a long build-up to these games, many controversies along the way about the pace of construction, would it get done? It does seem to be falling into place now. You've both clearly survived it, but has it been a major disruption for you?
Oh, yeah, it has been very difficult, but I think it was worth it because Athens is now wearing its best. It's an amazing renovation that has been done, a revamping of the city. Many buildings have been painted. Advertising signs have gone down. The sidewalks have been redone again. Flowers are planted in all the major parks. It's really an amazing renovation. I can go on and on.
And traffic actually moves now, or it used to crawl just a couple of weeks ago. So this is something.
And how do you account for that, John?
Well, I mean, they finished with all the major venues. They finished with the roads, etc. I mean, just to give you an idea, about a month ago, to come from Rafina to Athens, which is a distance of 27 kilometers, that's about, say, 20 miles, it took us 3.5 hours. Now, a marathon runner could do it running backwards. None of this. Now it moves smoothly. It's very good.
And Connie, inside the city, I know that Athenians are not generally noted for their calm and orderly driving habits. are people sort of behaving themselves a little better on the roadways?
There's an amazing change, you know. People are cooperating. They really want these games to work. And this is what has amazed me the most. You know, everybody's so cooperative. People are proud of their city now. They're taking care of it, it seems.
It'll be nice if it continues a bit longer. Mm. I mean, after the games.
And I understand there are lots of young volunteers out on the streets decked out in shorts and blue T-shirts. Are there any tourists yet for them to be helpful to?
Oh, yes. Yes, many tourists. And the volunteers are everywhere with their smart uniforms. We see them everywhere now. And they're going to their, you know, positions. And the staff of the metro and the trains are...
They're actually polite. You know, Athens and Greece in general is not known as a very polite nation.
I was going to say, you sound so surprised.
Very, very polite people, very polite people. And that's a nice change for it.
And I also understand that the people who zip around the city on motorcycles are actually wearing helmets these days?
Well, not all of them, you know. This is something that most foreigners do not understand, actually. They don't understand why most Greek motorcyclists carry these helmets around the elbows. The reason you wear it on your head is to protect your brain. the part of your body you think with. That makes sense, right? But what sense does it make if you think with your elbow?
When all of this is over and the tourists are gone and the games are but a memory, will Athens be a nicer city for you to live in?
I think I've already seen the changes, and these are permanent changes. When the tourists are gone, we will be left with all these venues and the roads and the transportation. So, yes, I think it will be a different city from now on.
We'll be left with a big bill as well, but that's tomorrow's problem.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Most definitely. What to do?
Well, we wish you all the best and hope the games will be uneventful and just as everyone would like to see them to be.
Thank you so much. I hope you can come and visit us during the games. Thank you.
We'll show you the new Athens.
Okay.
Thank you both.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Connie Lambrou-Philipson and her husband John Philipson spoke to us from Greece. Next time on Here and Now, although they're too young to vote, politically active kids can help get their parents to the polls. A new book points the way. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This week's terror alerts stumped one of the most powerful men in Washington. Executive editor of the Washington Post, Leonard Downey, told the New York Times, "We're a little confused. And to think, he and other news icons had their own private conference call with Homeland Security Chief Tom Ridge on Sunday afternoon, before Ridge's public announcement that there was a treasure trove of intelligence pointing towards attacks in New York, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. A day later, it was learned the information was years old, but the next day's headlines said there's new information as well. And besides, Al-Qaeda takes years to act on its intelligence, so old intelligence is good." What to make of this week in the war on terror? Joining us on the line are Rod Dreher, assistant editorial page editor of the Dallas Morning News. He's in Dallas. Hi, Rod.
Hello there.
And we also have Frank James, a national correspondent covering Homeland Security for the Chicago Tribune. He's based in Washington. Hi, Frank.
Hi.
And Rod, to you first. I mean, you wrote an editorial about these terror alerts. What's your overall thought about how they were handled?
Well, I should start by saying that I don't think the government handles this well at all in general. But on the thing that we wrote about and we focused on specifically in our editorial was this notion, this conspiratorial notion, that the government is raising these terror alerts for political advantage, for President Bush's political advantage. We think that's nonsense. We think that the government is in a damned if you do, damned if you don't position. If they had information and didn't come out and make it public, then God forbid something would happen. We would be baying for their blood for letting them allow something terrible to happen. If they do come out with information, scare everybody, and nothing happens, then people get angry with them for being chicken littles. So I think they're in a real bad position, and I think the thing that we need to do as much as possible is to have patience with them during this time, because it's not going to get any better in our lifetime.
Well, I want to stop you there for a second and ask Frank in Washington, what about Tom Ridge's comments in his announcement? The exact words, "We must understand that the kind of information available to us today is the result of the president's leadership in the war against terror." Is that comment, as someone said, politicizing the announcement?
Oh, most definitely. That right there sounded like a campaign ad to many people. And it was inappropriate for, at least many people thought it was inappropriate for the Secretary of Homeland Security to inject that in the same press conference where he was talking about the most alarming information that we have ever seen in terms of detail. So then the next day or two days later, the secretary says, we don't do politics. But he proved on Sunday that they do politics at the Department of Homeland Security.
I think Frank is right about that. It was a foolish thing for Ridge to have done. I wouldn't think he did it deliberately, but in any case, he shouldn't have done it. It is absolutely important, absolutely crucial that from here on out, whoever is in power, Republicans or Democrats, that they take extra steps to keep from politicizing this information.
Hey, Rod, I wanted to ask you, you're there in Dallas with Dallas Morning News. We understand that this story also resonated differently in different parts of the country, and did you feel that as well?
Well, I'm actually a strange person to ask because I lived in New York on 9/11. I was downtown when the towers collapsed, and I detect here in Texas and in Dallas a very September 10th kind of mentality. People don't seem to want to believe that we are in the war that I believe we are in. They don't think it's going to happen here or it could happen here. And on the one hand, that's one reason we moved to Texas, so we can get out of ground zero. But at the same time, I sense a real danger here. People outside of New York and Washington, where this is a very real threat, and people feel it every day, I feel like people are complacent. Here in North Texas, we're dealing now with the Holy Land Foundation, which has been accused in federal indictments of having funneled money to Hamas. There's a very large and powerful and wealthy Muslim community here in North Texas, and there's a lot of radicalism that goes on there. And frankly, I think the media are not paying enough attention to it.
What about yesterday's domestic arrests in Albany, New York? The first report said two mosque leaders had been arrested in a plot to buy a shoulder-fired missile to assassinate a Pakistani ambassador. Later reports said the men were actually caught in a year-long FBI sting. The missile belonged to the FBI. The men were approached by an agent, asked to launder money. The government has not yet said why it chose yesterday to arrest them. Frank, your thoughts?
I think the reporting has been straightforward. Now, whether or not the announcement of this sting operation is straightforward, that's another matter. I tend to think that, and I'll say this, that we don't have, at least I don't have a lot of evidence for this, maybe even any evidence for this, but I tend to think that the administration is right now rolling out a plan to essentially show that it is fighting this war on terror very, very aggressively. And when you see something like what happened on Thursday, where you get this announcement of a sting operation, well, why was it announced yesterday? Why was it announced on Thursday in the middle of all of this, you know, terror alert and the arrest in Britain and the arrest in Pakistan? It just looks like, again, this is a staged operation.
Rod.
I don't know if it's staged or not. I can agree with Frank that we have an obligation to be suspicious and to question the government. And if anybody in government, Republican or Democrat, are playing politics with the war on terror, then they should be called on it. That said, I'm so frustrated with the way this government handles the security situation. On the one hand, they seem to be saying, go out there, travel, shop, live your lives normally. We'll take care of you. Oh, and by the way, we're going to push the terror alert up one color. I mean, it's schizophrenic in a way. I feel like that they're not leveling with the public about what threat is really out there in a way that would help the public become more resilient psychologically and more prepared for the inevitable.
I agree. This is Frank speaking. I agree with Rod that it is a schizophrenic approach, and it really dates back to the days after September 11. I can remember very vividly the president was at Camp David. It might have been September 14, September 13 of 2001. He was asked what the American people should do right on the heels of 9/11, and he said, well, they should continue on, they should shop, they should do whatever they plan to do, basically not calling on the American people for sacrifice. That's followed through into the Iraq war. The American people really haven't been asked to sacrifice, who I believe would sacrifice if they were asked to do it.
If they were led to do it, I believe
you're right there.
And I think that our leaders are pandering to the people's desire and understandable desire for normality, for a September 10th normality. I don't think we can afford that.
That's right.
Well, I just want to ask you a quick question because I can hear at least some people thinking it. What else would they do, Rod? What else would they do if they have what they believe is important information? What else should happen?
Well, I think they did the right thing in this case by deploying armed officers in front of the Citicorp building in New York and these other places. But I wish that they would be as forthcoming with the public as they possibly can without compromising their sources and give people specific information about what to watch out for.
Absolutely right. And I think that that's really what we ought to be doing in addition to some of the steps we're taking right now.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Pleasure being here.
Yes.
Frank James is a national correspondent for the Chicago Tribune. He reports on homeland security issues. He's based in Washington, D.C. Rod Dreher, assistant editorial page writer at the Dallas Morning News, he spoke to us from Dallas, Texas.
Still to come, how Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 is playing in at least one city in the Arab world.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Whether it's classical music heard along the Rhine or folk songs on the mountaintops of Appalachia, cellist Yo-Yo Ma's ears are always open to music from around the world. His latest journey takes him to the bossa nova sounds of Brazil on a CD called Obrigado Brazil, Live in Concert. His efforts earned him a Latin Grammy nomination in the Best Instrumental category. Producer David Shulman brings us Yo-Yo Ma in his own words.
Playing music that is not part of a supposed record bin category has incredible effect on music that I've played 1/6 of my life. I've played, Prelude of a Bach Suite for Wynton Marsalis, and he says, first great jazz composer. So the idea of what's strange, what's familiar, what's other, and what's mine, often are little tiny differences that become amplified. You know, when you vibrate in a romantic concerto, you basically roll your finger. In other types of music, you could actually move your whole finger to make it as wide as you want. If you can find what's the activating, where I call the DNA of some style, then you can start growing from that style. I think that in the spirit of jamming, you're essentially saying everything goes, nobody can make a mistake, and anybody that does something differently gets actually incorporated into the flow. With, the great Brazilian musicians I've been working with recently, we were trying to do a piece, So Dança Samba, which was originally going to be Rosa Passos singing alone. Well, she sings alone, she's playing on the guitar. And then the next thing that happens is Ciro Baptista is joining her on percussion. And Sergio Assad is playing the guitar, suddenly strumming. And then Paquito then comes in with his incredible charm and witty clarinet playing. And suddenly it's a group piece. It's not about different categories, not even about improvising or text music or this, that. It's just saying, how many ways can you express yourself? There are many, many ways that one could look at any complex piece of music, because that's what good music is all about. There's a multitude of ways, and I think this is just a giant invitation to be as inventive as one can.
Our visit with Yo-Yo Ma was produced by David Shulman.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 continues to provoke strong reaction and make news, not just in the U.S., but abroad. The movie will soon be in theaters in Syria and Egypt and open last weekend in Beirut, Lebanon. Well, we thought we'd ask Rami Khoury, editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, how the Arab audience there is receiving the film. And Rami joins us on the line, so give us the headline. Do they like it?
Yeah, I think people like it because they're interpreting it as a movie that is critical of George Bush and the way that he hoodwinked the American people into waging a war in Iraq.
And, of course, this is something that people in Beirut enjoy hearing?
Well, it's what they believe. I mean, the vast majority, I would say 80-90% of people in the Middle East are critical of what the Americans did in Iraq. And I think this movie very much reinforces the sentiments that they already feel, though there's aspects of the movie, of course, which people here are a bit dubious about, the portrayal of the Saudis and maybe some other things.
Well, I was going to say, in the film, Michael Moore points out what he sees as unseemly financial ties between the Saudi royal family and the Bush family. Arabs in America and elsewhere are calling the film racist. Kuwait banned the film because they say it twisted the truth about its Saudi neighbors. So what are people saying there in Beirut?
The people I've talked to, and then when we went to see the movie the other day, I think people generally sense that it was a little bit exaggerated. The Saudi link was, I wouldn't say racist, but I would say it painted broad brush strokes in sort of black and white, where there are actually more nuances and shades of gray. So it was a little bit simplistic in terms of portraying the Saudis, and that's one of the problems, I think, with the movie, is that it did provide a rather inaccurate stereotype of Arabs.
Rami, do people in Beirut know that while there are people in America who embrace the film, there are people here that hate it? How do they feel about Americans? What questions are they asking about Americans after seeing the film?
I don't think they ask a lot of questions about Americans. I think they ask a lot of questions about George Bush. Mm-hmm. And I think this whole conspiracy theory paradigm that comes through in the movie is one that unfortunately triggers or connects well with many people's thinking here. And this is one of the, I think, intellectual weaknesses of the modern Arab political system, where people too easily fall into accepting conspiracy theories and plots. And that movie, I think, feeds into that sentiment more.
What's the overall feeling about the movie? Is it like, you've got to go see this movie? Is it sold out? What's the sense of it?
No, it's not. It's a movie that appeals mainly to westernized, globalized Arabs who are interested in political issues. It's not a movie that the average person is going to go see. And the people that I've talked to who've seen it, they'll say, oh, yeah, that was kind of interesting. He overdid the Saudi thing, but it shows us what Bush is really like. And then, you go on to talk about the local football soccer match or the Olympics or the Asian soccer tournament that just happened. Again, like most people in the U.S., they'll talk about a political thing and then they'll talk about what's really important in their lives, which is their college football team or their college basketball team or whatever.
Rami Khoury, thank you.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Rami is editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, Lebanon.
Michael Winterbottom is a chameleon of a film director. He's gone from the Thomas Hardy adaptation Jude to the war drama Welcome to Sarajevo to the Manchester music scene biopic 24-Hour Party People. And now he's taking on the venerated genre of science fiction with Code 46, starring Tim Robbins and Samantha Morton.
I came to Shanghai to investigate a fraud. And knew you were guilty. Then I fell in love with you.
Here and Now film reviewer Ted Barron says diehard sci-fi fans might be disappointed with Code 46. And that's probably for the same reasons he thinks the film is worth seeing. Hi, Ted.
Hi, Gail.
So it sounds as if you're saying this isn't Blade Runner or Alien or 2001. So how does Code 46 break from what we're accustomed to seeing in science fiction?
Well, it's much more focused on the love story in the film. There are two characters played by Tim Robbins and Samantha Morton in the film. And typically, sci-fi films are much more focused on the sort of gadgetry and the space and, you know, sort of trying to establish this world that's so much unlike the world that we know in the everyday life, whereas this film uses this very powerful relationship between these two people as the core of the film. So in taking that approach, you get very different results.
So it's not just the gee whiz of the gadgetry.
No, far from it. In fact, it tries to go for a much more naturalistic look. I mean, you see a lot of handheld camera shots. The film stock has a real grainy look to it, almost at times looking something like a documentary. It's not to say that there aren't any gadgets. They do have some pretty neat ways of sort of carrying photos of their kids around with them. And you do see, you know, very glossy airports and workplaces. But the general focus tends to be more towards a realistic space that's much more plausible to what we would experience now in our everyday life.
Well, let's set the scene here. It's kind of a sci-fi love story. It takes place in the future. There are the haves who live in tightly secured cities, and there are the have-nots who are outside in kind of shanty towns. Tim Robbins is an insurance investigator who is sent out to look into some faked papers or papels, and that's how he meets up with Samantha Morton's character.
Right. She plays the employee of the company who's actually producing these counterfeit papels, which serve as a kind of futuristic way of tracking your identity and giving you access to the inside world being sort of a more privileged space versus this outside space of shanty towns.
And what is Code 46?
Well, Code 46 is sort of the big secret of the film. It's a reflection on this sort of futuristic world in which cloning becomes much more commonplace, and there's a violation which emerges within the film, which I won't reveal. It's kind of the big plot twist in the film.
Well, and what about the choice of these two actors? I mean, Samantha Morton might seem to be a somewhat obvious choice because she was in the Minority Report.
Right.
And Tim Robbins is always interesting, I think, in whatever he does.
He's
not so obvious.
Well, he's good in the film. I mean, it's funny because one of the things that struck me about using the two of them, it almost looks like the choice of casting Bill Murray opposite Scarlett Johansson in Lost in Translation, where you have this very tall actor against a smaller woman. And the dynamic of the relationship is very similar in that when they come together, it's in these very sort of quiet moments.
Tell me what you're doing later tonight.
Is that a question or an invitation?
It's a prompt.
Tonight, I am going to stay awake till the sun goes down. I'm not going to sleep.
Pourquoi?
It's my birthday.
Happy birthday.
He supposedly has some great lines in the film, but I'm always struck by just how he looks. You know, he conveys so much just through expression.
Yeah, he's fairly quiet in the film. I mean, he does have some great lines, especially when he's using what's called an empathy virus to get information about this counterfeiting scheme.
And an empathy virus would be?
Well, an empathy virus, again, in this sort of futuristic world, everything's being determined by these kinds of internal factors. I mean, empathy virus is a virus that he takes so that he can understand other people's thoughts.
If I could figure out your password, your palabra.
You couldn't do it.
I just needed to know one piece of information.
Look, is this some kind of trick?
No. It could be anything. Just one thing. Tell me one thing about yourself. Mm-hmm. Anything at all.
My birthday. My palabra's not my birthday. But no.
Your palabra is Carrefour. Crossroad. Carrefour.
Wait. How did you know that?
Can I register
wait,
now?
Wait. How did you know my palabra?
I listened to you while you weren't speaking.
So many sci-fi films are political in some way. You know, they take on the military-industrial complex or artificial intelligence or cloning. What are the issues here?
Well, it's certainly this divide between the world of the inside and the world of the outside. I mean, the sense of, you know, what's this impact of global economies as people become wealthier and wealthier, or other people becoming much less so. And one of the other interesting sort of political elements in the film is this use of language. They speak in this kind of Esperanto, which is a predominantly English language that they use, but there are all these inflections of Spanish and French and Japanese that start to sort of filter into the language, in the sense is that in the future, everyone's going to speak this way.
All right. In a word, worth seeing?
I think so. I was really moved by the characters, especially Samantha Morton. She's an incredible actress, and she's really quite strong in this. I mean, you mentioned Minority Report. She has a much stronger role in this film, and she's not actually a conventional choice as a sort of leading romantic actress. She's incredibly magnetic in this. I mean, very strong performance and really holds the camera very well.
Thanks, Ted.
Thank you.
Ted Barron, programmer at the Harvard Film Archive, talking about Michael Winterbottom's new film, Code 46. He
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Minigon, April Peavy, Ellen Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Mike Toda. Our web producer is Zach Christo. And our interns are Nick Wise Richmond, Alexis Delvecchio, and Pove Path.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Have a good weekend.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.